everyone, it's Noor. We're ready to hop into another great episode of AdTech Unfiltered this month. But right before we do that, if you like AdTech Unfiltered, if you wouldn't mind giving us a 5-star review in your podcasting app, that helps a ton and we'd sincerely appreciate it. For this month's episode, we're talking about running a digital agency. How do you run a digital agency successfully in today's hyper-competitive landscape? Who decides to start one? How do you start one? How do you manage it? How do you pitch clients? And then how do you keep them? And what about revenue models? There's a ton of questions. To get some quality perspective, we speak to former agency partner and president, Mitch Joel. He was formerly the president of digital agency Twist Image, which he sold with his partners to media holding company WPP. Mitch is also a digital marketing and technology speaker, consultant, and entrepreneur. He's the author of books 6 Pixels of Separation and Control-Alt-Delete. This episode on running the digital agency of today starts right now. Mitch, it's awesome having you here this morning to share your perspective as a former agency owner on running a competitive agency today.
I'm happy to be here, Noor. It's always great to hear your voice.
So I'm going to start at the very beginning, Mitch. You became an equal partner in an agency called Twist Image back in 2002, and you served as the company president. You really understand the nuts and bolts of building and growing an agency, so much so that you maintained that agency for well over a decade before selling it to WPP. So really trust your advice in understanding the nuances of building an agency, but also more specifically, a digital agency. Just in terms of at the very beginning, when you joined this organization and became a partner, what were some of the opportunities that attracted you to founding or starting and leading an agency?
Oh, I mean, it was such a different time for me, Noor. I was running a record label with a business partner of mine in Toronto. I'm based in Montreal, and it was going well, but we always perceived it to be a small business. These were very eclectic types of bands that we didn't think would sell a ton of records. We believed in the music and the artists, but we weren't expecting platinum type of outcomes with these artists. And I had wanted to take my work, which was prior to that in the world of technology and media and communications and publishing, and build on it. So the idea was to launch a consulting service. And then I had met the two people who had built this agency, Twist Image, Mick and Aubrey, through some community type work. And I always had them in the back of my mind as people I'd like to connect with at one point. And so I met with them and said, look, if I start this business, can you handle or would you be interested in any work, you know, the physical stuff that would come out of it? Because they were doing business cards and logos and CD-ROMs at the time and starting into the web space, but it was still, you know, quite new. And then after sitting around in their space, which was very small with just, you know, 2 or 3 other employees, I thought I really like this. And the stuff I'm selling is kind of the work they're doing. And we just had a conversation about me not really building a consulting business, but rather joining them. So I got rid of the record label part, gave it back to my business partner, just took out, you know, took back what I'd put in, which wasn't that much. And so it was myself, Aubrey, and Mick. We brought in a third partner, Mark, a fourth partner rather, total, Mark, who had built FCB, another large agency up in Canada, and he had moved on from there. And we thought we could use some gray hair and a bit of direction in terms of what it means to manage a business. So there was that work that had to happen. But at the same time, blogging was coming out. I had been very active as a journalist in media, so I was trying to reach out to the trade publications and getting a name for ourselves. And again, the reaction back was, well, who are you and what have you done? And the answer was not much. We were a very new and small agency. So I started blogging and podcasting again back in 2003, 2004, when it was very, very small and very communal, but it worked. And then we started getting the attention of the trade publications and the industry associations. We got very engaged with that. And we recognized very early that thought leadership is important. But if you could monetize thought leadership, that would be even more important. Because monetizing thought leadership meant that we were offsetting the extreme costs you have as an agency on the business development side, which is quite extensive. And it really did work. So while I had the title of president, I don't know that I was anything more than somebody banging the drum while at the same time being very interested in the space and able to communicate to clients what the offering was and what it could look like. But you're right. I mean, at the time, social media was very nascent. E-commerce was very nascent. Mobile was even more nascent. So there was a long road that we were able to recognize and stay on. And we were just lucky that we had great clients and were able to build, you know, a pretty substantive small business. We opened up an office in Toronto. And I think when we sold to WPP, which is now about 7 years ago, we were over 100 people, which is fairly large for Canada, very large in general as an independent digital-only shop. And it was an incredible experience. I mean, it really was an incredible journey. And one of the things that, you know, I talk often about or reflect on more intimately with myself is in the fact that the real magic of it could have been the work and the team and all those great things we talk about. But to me, the real magic was in the fact that as partners, four very different and unique individuals, we really got along well. And we really, to this day, love each other and spend time with each other. And there's none of that working with somebody and hating them or trying to get them out of the business. I mean, we worked for many, many years through many ups and downs and maintained not only a professional relationship, but a real friendship.
I want to get back to that point you just made of being friends and having those relationships with the partners a little bit later, but I wanted to touch back on something that you mentioned earlier, it being 2002, getting into blogging, thought leadership in a digital format. I feel like by 2002, we had hit the point where maybe a lot of people have now subscribed to the internet, but it was still early days and not necessarily every person or every household had access to quality internet connection. So I'm just curious, being a lead at an agency, what was the receptivity around building content in digital spaces and spending a lot of energy there when so many people in the agency business were still very focused in using their dollars and or pitching business that was focused on traditional media?
Yeah, I mean, look, I was in digital long before that. And in the early 90s, I was publishing physical magazines and writing about the internet as it was. I worked at one of the first search engines before Google. I worked at one of the first content providers for mobile platforms before there was ever a smartphone or mobile web browser. So that earliness of AOL CDs, I remember well. By 2000, there was a higher level of sophistication. There definitely was broadband. People were excited about having websites. This is beyond the dot-com boom bust and echo. This was the real wave where people were able to finally build real things. We had to do a lot of convincing in the early days. We were still getting a lot of calls that were, well, come and explain to me like why I need a website, or come and explain to me why I need email marketing. We were quickly able to shift from being in the convincing business to being in a place where businesses understood that they were missing, that they didn't have this stuff. And because we were banging a loud drum in the media and everywhere, we were able to capture a lot of that attention. So we leveraged these digital platforms as a way to also capture mindshare.
For a digital agency today, what do you think agency owners or people who want to build an agency need to be keeping in mind so that they're actually offering something unique to this digital marketplace out there?
I get asked this question a lot, and I think about it a lot. If I were starting an agency today, what kind of agency would it be? Right? Like, that's kind of what you're asking. I believe being platform or niche specific can be very, very powerful. We were very much a jack of all trades, and we were very much supplementing where the traditional agencies were leaving off. Because you're right, going back to your last question, many of the traditional agencies were really still pushing on their traditional models, and we could supplement it. And instead of becoming the agency of record, we were able to gobble up that Pac-Man game board in terms of budget because we were offering all the things they couldn't offer. If you fast forward to where we're at today, I'll throw a couple of ideas at you as agencies I would think very seriously about. I think about things like Substack, email, and newsletters being an agency world unto itself. I look at things like audio, podcasting, social audio, digital audio, voice technology, your Alexas and Googles of the world, all of that as its own world. Video, helping people optimize against things like YouTube, Facebook Live, LinkedIn, et cetera, its own little world. Shopify, e-commerce, helping businesses really optimize against e-commerce and what that looks like. Mobile, being a space unto itself. Real development of not just applications, but ways in which to engage on mobile, because most brands, from what I see, even in, you know, I'm very removed. It's been 3 years since I've been in the office. Most brands still, to me, optically, when I see them, look like they're operating still from a very web first instead of mobile first strategy. And then I think within advertising, there's still a lot of opportunities to be great, whether it's a combination of a Facebook, YouTube, Google, Twitter, Snapchat, whatever, a real packaging of it in a really efficient and effective way. There's not many 800-pound gorillas there. And I could go on and on. And I think each one of those could have a better exit than we had. And we had a pretty good exit. I think there are opportunities to really help businesses grow in that. And I also feel that if you are more of a generalist and you can really add them on and mix and match, I believe that could be a great model as well.
I think people want to go the generalist route because they feel their safety in diversifying, when what ends up happening is that you don't address that question I originally asked, which is, how do you bring something unique to the table? Well, I'm not bringing something unique to the table because I'm trying to offer too many things and hoping that something is going to stick, when people really could be putting a lot of time and energy to specialization. But I wonder if the fear is associated with specializing in the thing that's going to tank, having too many eggs in one basket. Do you think that's a fear that some agencies have? Is there kind of a Goldilocks approach, you know, doing too many things versus doing too few things and finding the right middle space?
Feedback is real. So you start seeing immediately, based on requests of what you're getting from clients or what you're able to sell, against what you can really produce efficiently, effectively, and really make money on. One of the things I see at a fundamental level is that agencies don't understand their margins. The business model is very simple, right? We're selling a human unit of time for more money than we pay for it. If you could add on layers, so I know you're more specialized in analytics, and analytics is a great example of being able to not only provide the package, but provide services on top of that and optimization and other components of it, but you're making yourself somewhat invaluable. The agency review will come and go based off of the CMO or VP marketing coming in or out. But ultimately, if there's this great shop that does analytics and they support our analytics infrastructure and they're constantly feeding us opportunities to make more money, I don't think you're going to have too big of a problem in that review. You might have the next agency come in and claim to be able to do that too. But again, when you're really embedded, good luck with that. So to me, if I was starting today, I would start and be additive versus offering everything. Also, because we do live in a world where it is kind of satiated with that model, especially in advertising. Everybody claims to do everything. You know, we were finding competition in the end coming from event marketing agencies claiming they could do digital, you know, and I'm laughing because it sounds absurd, but they had digital capabilities and competencies and often did it quite well. So what would have been the opportunity? I'm competing with every other agency that they're partnering with, or I'm able to provide something solely unique. And if it works and I'm unique to them, that is an inclination that there are others who might require that type of service. I kept finding that just having the relationship with the client was enough to tell us what new services we needed to add. They would complain about another agency. They would say, I wish we could do this. They would say, I was speaking to somebody over in commerce that was talking about that. All of these little information bits would become things we would talk about at the management level of where do we go next. We found that the consultants would come in and get these massive mandates, and they would wind up interviewing us and taking our information and still get paid for it. And in the meantime, the agencies were always in the world of come to us with ideas, and they would never buy anything. And so we just took that consulting model and added it in the front end. So when the client came to us and said, hey, you know, can you give us some ideas around this? The answer was, well, usually when we engage with our clients, we start with a strategy mandate, and we wound up being compensated, and using that as what we call the tip of the spear, we wound up being compensated for work that was traditionally done for free. And so if the client would say things like, well, you know, our other agencies are always coming to us with ideas, we're like, great, we're a different type of agency. Maybe we're not the right fit for you. It's really hard to do those things. And even saying them, I can cringe when I say them. But it was a way in which we could establish something unique and or different about us. And then what wound up happening is they loved the strategy and they loved paying for it because it was so much cheaper than what they were getting from the Accentures and Deloittes in the world, but it was of equal quality.
So you bring up a really good point. Going back to something you said a little bit earlier, as far as getting the clients to pay for what they may otherwise have been seeing as like a throw-in or freebies, was there a cultural shift that had happened that led them to a place where they found it acceptable to pay for those services that they were otherwise getting for free? Or what happened that enabled them to see value so much that they once were paying and now they were open to it?
Two things. One is the agencies that they worked with were coming to them with media solutions. Oh, this is your brand problem. Here's a TV ad you should buy or radio spot. Or two was they were coming at them with a creative solution that resulted in a TV ad. So that was the shift. Is they're talking about how do we digitally engage? And they're like, well, you should make this TV ad and then you can put it on YouTube. It's a very traditional thinking. We were coming at it like, I don't know if you need a TV ad, but we can build you this microsite and do targeting and start collecting some data, sending out a valuable email or communication. Within that, we can create a level of offering. We can do some split A-B testing. It was just a completely overhauled way of thinking about not only advertising, but creating content as an engine of media. And also monetizing the content you're creating because you're building this database of users or customers who are opting in to hear from you. So again, this stuff sounds very traditional now, but back then that was the competition.
When I think of you, Mitch, I think of a person who is an expert lasso thrower for, what is it, herding cats? Yeah. Or herding whatever, you know, whatever kind of metaphor you want to use for clients, because I think sometimes what ends up happening is that folks are spinning out of control for a variety of different reasons. But then ultimately, what is the responsibility of the agency to put everything in perspective? So I want to use that to segue into a question around building products and building solutions. It's a complex challenge for a lot of agencies to face, especially since it seems like digital products and buzzwords and what's new and late breaking is changing every day. There's a lot of misinformation out there. What was and what is, let's say, if you were continuing to build products today, what are some of your core beliefs around making sure you're approaching that in a way that is going to enable you to continue to get everybody aligned and get people aligned with what it is that you're bringing to the table?
You know, again, I'm going to keep repeating that different times and different opportunities, the client comes to you and says, we want to sell 1,000 cars in this region. And you'd look at it and see what they were being offered from other partners. And the joke is, I was talking about maybe we should print up some postcards and then go put them on people who buy your car, what model of car do they buy before, and just go to all the shopping malls and parking lots and put that card of offer into the windshield of all the cars that people usually buy before they buy your car. And that'll be the cheapest way to do this. You probably do it for a couple $1,000. And again, we were a digital agency and we were tossing the work away because we're thinking, you know, you're going to build a microsite, you're going to do all this online advertising. For that type of work, there's a very specific tactic that can be done. And the realization from that analogy or that story is just because you sell something or this is the things you sell, it may not be the right solution for the client. Now, to transpose that into the work we did, we were digital. So we were always showing them things that were cheaper than trying to produce an ad that you're going to send out in a mass model and hope that enough people who are interested in it convert to that. So you're showing them things like pay-per-click. You're showing them things like news. You're just showing them landing pages, offers that no one's showing them. And that optimization of it really was built around this model of, look, you're going to wind up spending maybe a bit less than you would in a traditional advertising campaign. But the truth is, when you get started with us, you should be spending less overall. But in truth, you should be spending a lot more because everything you're doing is generating you more revenue.
I appreciate that long-term strategic approach because I think what happens these days is there's always this squirreling approach where there's a couple of nuts and everybody's grasping for them and they're just worried about that and they're not thinking about the bigger vision and how important that is for the longevity of an agency's reputation. So that's kind of what I took away from what some of what you shared as far as sometimes not immediately grasping for an opportunity and, you know, pushing them to something else, something that you don't offer, but overall protecting what it is that you bring to the table from a like thought leadership perspective, and then building out more of the tactical details around that.
And knowing yourself as an agency, knowing your team, we shied away from media spend, traditional and digital. We would create it, but we would find partners. We just weren't good. We had a couple of real false starts in bringing media inside that didn't work for us at the beginning. So we didn't do it. Trying to think of other components where it just wasn't our jam. Search engine optimization, search engine marketing rather, that became so specialized as we grew and grew that we just felt we weren't able to keep up with some of the other niche agencies that were so good at it. So you're also able to pick your battles. And again, could that lead to the client thinking, well, you can't service us, so we need to move on? It could, but our experience was appreciate the honesty. Who do you think can do it? And what's interesting in that is more often than not, it was their realization that their actual media business wasn't being handled well. So we could make referrals and bring people in, but it was amazing to watch them review their traditional agency structures, their media agency structures, because as they worked more and more building these tools out, they were like, what's going on over there? Why are we doing all this stuff over here? If we can do all that here, what are we doing over there? So it changed the industry. Now, it's not that we as Twist Image changed the world. We didn't. We happened to be on the surfboard as the wave was going. So we were there.
I'm reflecting on something I heard you say a few moments ago as far as deciding when it is that you will assess if you should, let's say, bring media in-house or some sort of solution in-house for you to handle versus when you're going to turn to a partnership. What did that assessment process look for your team? Because I'm sure a lot of agencies or consulting services their goal is to bring as much in-house as they possibly can. What do you recall that process being like for you?
It's very different as the business transforms. You know, day one is you'll do anything. Business card, you need a logo. What do you need? We'll do it. And we did. And we did a lot of that. And then as you build your reputation and as you build your clients and as you start seeing the requests for proposals, the RFPs that come in, the pitches that are out in the general media, you start refining and tweaking and you hit a level of elegance where this is the stuff we're really sweet at that we can repeat, that we can make money on. If we add this in, what is the runway to figure out how we can do this effectively and not kill ourselves? So what made us unique that was never optically visible to anybody but the management team maybe and the partners is that we ran it as if it were a public company and or one that would be liked by an acquirer, a potential acquirer. Not with the intention of ever selling it, because we really didn't have the intention of selling it at all. But because we knew that there is a financial way of running a business that is going to make this profitable, because ultimately the agency business is a business of nickels and dimes. It's a business of very thin or tight margins, depending on where you are. And that if you don't run it that way, you can run yourself out. So it was a very different way to think about it. And then as you grow and get good and see your marketplace, you start questioning. So when we questioned media the first time, it was early days and it seemed to make sense. When we questioned it the second time, it was probably on the fence. By the third time we looked at it, there was too much competition that would make it the barrier to entry too hard. And also might detract from what our core offering really was.
Yeah. What I think about today is that culturally speaking, there is so much more discussion around fake it till you make it. You know, don't look at what the downside could be. There's so much technology out there or opportunities for automation that could assist you to bring something in-house that you otherwise don't have like a historical specialization in or specialty around. So I guess what I'm getting at is that people have this hope or this optimism that they're going to figure it out. Sometimes maybe they're wearing rose-colored glasses in that assessment. So I'm curious, just for like one more iteration of the question, when do you go for that? When does it make sense to say, okay, we actually do want to build up a capacity to specialize in something that we currently don't have infrastructure for, but we think it's worth it to build out the pipes to make it happen?
Well, I mean, look, that ties directly into why did we sell? We sold because we hit a point where we realized we wanted to scale significantly, but we didn't want to self-finance it and or be 100% the entrepreneurs to do that, the dreamers. At that point, we realized it's time to sell. At what point are you still an entrepreneur and willing to take on the personal risk to do that? Taking your eye off of the current path that's working, hopefully, changing staff, adding staff, the dynamics of the culture, all of these things. And we had long conversations about, are we becoming risk adverse? What would it be like to be in a major holding company? Would we feel like we're entrepreneurs trapped not being able to do anything, or would we be good operators? So to me, it's not a function of when is the right time. It's a function of who are you right now? Are you still extremely entrepreneurial and risk averse? Are you becoming more corporate? Are you thinking, I really like this business, I'm getting good margins, I can run with this a long time? I mean, there's no doubt you constantly have to innovate. You constantly have to rethink business models. There's no stagnation in any of the world of agency. But when you're making massive changes that are going to impact current models, you have to do it in a way, to from my perspective, that's intelligent. Because you don't want to be betting so hard on something else that you're eroding a healthy line as well. Now, if that line is dying, that's a whole other story. If what you're selling is currently not what the world is buying, it's now. You got to keep going until you figure it out. But if you're in a place where there's a healthy pipeline, if you're in a place where the business is brisk and the margins are strong, you need to be looking at what's going to really build that moat or that infrastructure around it, and thinking, well, where's this world going? And how does that impact me?
What I'm really taking away from what you're sharing is that when you are an agency or organizational leader, you need to be constantly be doing this really, the self-reflection and just taking a really good look in the mirror at what it is that you're bringing to the table and what it is that you have the capacity to do for the betterment of the business.
Yeah. And in the business you're in then, I would say, well, are you a value-added reseller? Are you really an agency? And then the analogy we would often talk about is, I'm going to give you this train. And then we would ask them, did we give them a track? Did we give them fuel? Did we give them a passenger cart? Did we give them a store? Like, we just gave them the train and said, good luck. They need to know where the rails go. They need to know how to power it. They need to know how to make it go faster, how to make it more efficient. So those are the questions that we often reflected more on than the shiny, bright object of, well, let's be a Facebook agency now, or let's be, or today it's thinking about Clubhouse or thinking about TikTok. Or it was less about that and more about, okay, well, if we're seeing things like TikTok and Clubhouse happen, what's the connective tissue there? It seems to be around content. It seems to be around things that are video, audio based. It seems to be around an influencer culture. There were things from that you could then go back and say, so based off of the core work that we do, how do we add value to those? And then keeping that flow going. So we had a lot of success with that, with just the world of, here are the tools we gave you, but we're going to be filling it with content and ideas and helping you really do different things with it. That was very successful for us. And again, going back to one of your first questions, it's huge. I mean, being in marketing automation, being in media automation, all of that stuff in and of itself is its own world.
I love the analogy you shared about the trains. Like, are you offering a track? Are you offering a train car? I think sometimes when you get into the grind of daily business, it's very easy to start losing track around what it is that you're really delivering because you're just obsessed with the hustle and bustle of the next thing. So I think that's fantastic advice. So I said I was going to come back to this, Mitch, about leadership. And you mentioned that you loved your partners and you still have strong relationships with them. But I imagine that there are multiple takes. One take can be that that lots of leadership can equal differing viewpoints so that you have a more fair and balanced way of going about the business. And then another take can be that you've got a lot of cooks in the kitchen and there's more room for challenges that come alongside that. Why do you think your partners were able to function together in a really purposeful and successful way for your agency?
Simplistically, everything they did, I didn't want to do, and everything I did, they didn't want to do. And that speaks to every individual. The biggest challenge we saw is when it was two creative directors fighting over ideas. We had a CEO who was really senior level, really operating internally how the business is going to grow and work. We had myself as a president, which isn't really the title, where I was a storyteller, a salesperson, and very connected to the industry. We had Mick, who was the unicorn. Mick was the perfect intersection of a technologist and a creative director. And then we had Aubrey, who was really that hybrid of COO, CFO. And combined, it was just a team where I would never want to do the work Aubrey does. I would never want to do the work Mick does. I had no interest in the work Mark did. And they felt the exact same way about me and each other. And so when we went into rooms, it was almost like we had carved out our own areas. We respected each other. And then we also had on top of it, this idea that it's not about me and my idea. That if I'm outvoted, I'm outvoted. And I have to be okay with the fact that they are smart, intelligent, and individual human beings, and that they may be right, they may be wrong, but let's go with it. And so there was a lot of that as well, where even if I believed really, I mean, you know, again, I could show you the deck. I happen to be friends. I'm very lucky with Harley Finkelstein, who's now the president of Shopify, but was very, very early in there and their most vocal person. Over the years, again, we've maintained our friendship, a great person. I could go back and show you a deck from, you know, over 10 years ago where I was trying to explain to my partners why we should become a Shopify partner. And the truth of why it got shot down is because at the time, Shopify's changed a lot, Shopify was really catering to this solopreneur, this individual selling one or two products. That was really what it was at the beginning. I sell snowboards, I sell t-shirts, I sell bracelets. And we had had enough experience in our growth that we didn't want to go back to dealing with that type of business owner because everything is cost efficient. It's really small. It's just me. We were dealing with bigger brands with big, large national ongoing mandates. So it didn't fit in the world as it were. Now you fast forward and you think, wow, gee, imagine had we done that all the way back then where we would be. But we were already on a different track. So I was able to be upset with that choice because I really wanted to do that. But understand that that's taking us off of the direction we were going in.
So I want to take the topic of trust into a question about client expectations, meeting and managing their expectations, exceeding their expectations. You talked a little bit about the different types of clients that are out there. What did managing those client expectations look like? And what did you learn about managing client expectations all the way from the leadership level that you were at down to the folks that were doing the actual tactical work inside of your agency?
Okay, so I'll tell you where we netted out. And I feel it was a successful model and feel free to steal this. My real work was figuring out what the senior most client and the lead client, because they were often not the same people, needed to get their promotion, their bonus, or whatever they wanted to happen in their career. And then the instruction was really clear to our team. Make sure they get that. And you do whatever you can to support them on their journey. It took away all of the worries of ego. Because you'd be dealing with people who, I mean, egos are real. And the egos would be, this is the way I want it, this is, and you wind up having, unfortunately, more of a slave-master relationship than a partnership. But when your vested interest is the actual outcome they require for them to be satiated, that was core. Now, if that need of the client came at the expense of doing something really detrimental to the brand, it became almost a game of therapy where you're trying to get them to another headspace about what this can be. But ultimately, the relationships that we managed and managed well were done because our goal was to get the client to their goal.
So that answer feels initially very clarifying in that you're just cutting it down to the bare bones foundations as far as what it is that they're looking to achieve. But to refer back to something else that you said, sometimes that can turn into a really toxic relationship. They're expecting to say, we want this and we want you to do whatever it takes, even if it's really draining your team. So curious as far as how you manage that, because at the highest levels, you're responsible for figuring out what it is that they want. But then you have people who are working inside of your organization, maybe really feeling the brunt and the burden of taking on some of those challenges to help them meet those goals. What did juggling that look like for you as a leader?
It's the worst. I mean, it's the worst part of the job, keeping clients because it's so financially viable, but so draining to the team. It's terrible to know that there are team members who don't want to even touch that brand, who will no longer even shop that brand if they leave the agency. And it was a real balance of character and personality to figure out and be very, very clear. This is the brand. This is the client. This is the expectation. Here's your positives. Here's your negatives. We're always here to support you. We are always having hopefully higher or over the top conversations with whomever we need to. It was very, very rare that we had to go beyond the senior most client to another C-level executive to have a correction be in place. It was very rare, but I can tell you there's no doubt that we worked with some really, really tough clients. And when I say clients, it could be the individual who was leading, or it could just be the brand in general and their culture and how it works. Were there times where we fired a brand? Yes. Were there times where we hung on to a brand because it was paying well, but it was abusive? Yes. Am I proud of that? No. But I'm also thinking beyond and trying to get into a space of we are running a business. And although people think if they're an employee that, oh, it's just about lining the pockets of the owners, it really wasn't, because ultimately there's always something you can do when you're an entrepreneur to do it a different way. But it was really a factor of some people like working with difficult clients and know how to manage it and really enjoy that energy of trying to appease. And there are times where you look at it and think, I can't let go of this client because I wind up having to let go of people. And that's the hardest part that people who are employees of agencies don't always get. They don't always get the fact that if I push that client out the door, there's a swath of people here who don't have employment. I don't have another client sitting there who's paying us that type of revenue. So you're making that Sophie's choice. You're making that dilemmic choice of, you know, is the revenue worth the sacrifice of people being miserable? Or is it worse to have people leave? And again, when I reflect on the time to make this happier note, because that's a pretty bum out note, I always said it was like Goldilocks doesn't exist. We would always have employees who would say, there's too much work, it's too crazy, it's too busy, and quit. And then we always had employees that would say, it's not busy enough, you need more action, and I'm quitting. It was very rare that we had Goldilocks where it was just right. And as owners, we were also balancing that, because there were times where we've got this pitch or three pitches come in and we're going to work on the weekend. There were those times. We tried to not have crazy psycho agency from, you know, long ago of workaholics where, you know, you come into work and your creative director is walking out of the bathroom with a towel and a toothbrush in their mouth because they slept there all night. We did not have that. And we really pushed hard back on clients and beyond to not have that, what was the traditional agency culture, working around the clock for clients for all of these things. But in general, it was always this balance of sometimes the client is also just a tough client, but they're fair. They're tough, but it's fair. So it's harder to get the money. It's harder to do the work, but it's not unreasonable. So it's a person thing. Do we have other people who can work within that? And, I wish I could tell you we had the secret sauce and the formula that made it work and that we never had a negative review on Glassdoor and that we never had people quitting for every reason from I'm not paid enough to I'm not being valued. I mean, it was a challenge to do. But ultimately, I still believe it was an agency, which makes it fun because you're working on different types of clients. We had great space. we did have an environment that encouraged friendships and getting to know people and had a big social component to it, but fully understanding that it was a crazy time when businesses like Shopify and Google were offering way bigger salaries and bigger promotions. Business is tough. It's always been tough. So that's the balance of it. And again, sometimes it's the client, often it's yourself, and it's finding the balance in the middle.
So you mentioned trying to match up people's aptitude or interest, I would say, for particular types of clients, up with their interest in actually working on a certain type of client earlier on in our conversation. I wanted to connect that back to something you brought up way earlier, which is about the way that the revenue models are built for agencies. And you mentioned the human unit of time, or maybe an FTE model, billable hour model. I think some of that is really currently evaluated as far as, is this the right way for us to go? Are there new types of revenue models that people should be leaning into, specifically agency leaders? Do you think a shift in agency models is going to help make for happier employees?
Oh, Noor, I've been writing about this stuff for a long time. Why are we charging for a human unit of time? I mean, there's value. There's value in the fact that we've spent all these years and years doing value. We should do value-based pricing. Okay, sure. Like, okay, let's try it. Like, we just never came to a point where it worked, because as we worked with larger and larger clients, there was procurement, and procurement would come to you and say, well, this is how much we pay per hour for a web developer. This is how much we pay for client services. This is how much they were dictating back based off of their procurement models, what pricing looks like. And they ultimately wanted a rate. So did I say, well, Mitch Joel is this price and Noor is this price? No. If they wanted a breakdown, we could show them senior versus mid versus junior versus tech development versus creative. But we had blended rates. And that was how we worked. And we sometimes had established fixed pricing for products or projects, rather. Were we ever able to really benefit from this idea of value-based pricing? There was a couple of instances, not us, but other agencies that really had that position. It was a thing of prestige. It was a lot of PR, but ultimately it got eroded by these larger agencies who had pricing structures that were more transparent and more clear. People want to know what they're paying for. And so again, I can use it's analogous to what I do as a public speaker, right? Am I worth my speaking fee? I think it's a bit absurd if we're going to be friends and talk candidly between you and I. But then when I think about 30 plus years of professional work and what I do and what I build to get into that 45 minutes to make it what it is, I start getting it more. So, you know, you're definitely not paying on a time-based metric, because the number doesn't make sense. You're paying more for value. I have seen these models exist, but they're very tough. And they're very tough in digital also because of just the mechanics of it. You're buying software usually a SaaS model. So there's X amount of seats and access to it. There's some development that has to be done on top of it. There's some consulting. Clients want that transparency. So can you charge more per hour like lawyers do? I mean, of course you can. It's a service-based model. Will that hinder your business? Depends on who you're marketing to and who you're connecting to. Do I think you need to bake into your hourly rate the value? I think that that's there inherently if you know how to do your modeling correctly. So when people say, oh, you know, it's got to be something more than a human unit of time per hour, I'm like, well, it depends on how much you're valuing each human unit of time.
I'll have this be my final question, which is focusing on this concept of future-proofing, which I'm sure you've heard that buzzword thousands of times. The idea generally being that you want to future-proof your business or future-proof your agency to make sure that you're protecting yourself from, I don't know, like new industry variables or challenges and obstacles to make sure that you're sustaining your business and flourishing moving into the future. Do you believe that future-proofing is a real thing, and that as clients get more sophisticated, that agency leaders can successfully future-proof their organization?
Immortal question. I think about this idea of future-proofing because it is true that my branding platform of my speaking and the work that I do is, you know, I help people decode the future. It's decode the future. I help leaders decode the future, all that sort of stuff. Future-proofing has become a term that I'll look sideways a little bit on because of COVID. You know, COVID really changed my perspective on future-proofing. what I found during COVID is what I call this great compression, that all this digitization stuff that we thought was going to take a lot longer happened a lot quicker. And perhaps there was a realization within these moments and months and years that we've gone through this, that digitization is priority one, which means that my content is feeling way more immediate than it felt versus just out of reach for these businesses, which means I have to think differently about what are these models. So when I think about future proofing, what I think about is what consumer behavior has fundamentally changed today that you as a business or brand do not embrace. So a quick example, Netflix, Spotify, right? You're not buying a physical piece of media. You're spending a small monthly fee to have access to an entire library or catalog. So what are you selling as a one-time thing that you might be able to turn into giving your customer access to? So now suddenly you're opening up to self-service, you're opening up to contactlessness, you're opening up from sending PDFs to allowing them to self-serve through something. I believe within that comes real models that you can move forward with that ultimately will future-proof you, because all you're really doing is looking at what is a generalized consumer behavior that's been accepted. And what am I doing to mimic it? So another quick example would be, like, let's face it, if you want to mate with somebody, which I would think is a very complex cycle of like customer acquisition, all you have to do in this day and age is swipe left or right. And if I compare that experience of, let's call it Tinder, to what your mobile experience is in your website and how complex it is to find the phone number, what does that say about us? So can you future-proof your business by figuring out a swiping model of making people flow through your content or through your information a lot faster? So think about now companies that have any form of catalog or visualization. And this is, all of that stuff will quote unquote future-proof you, but all you're really doing is accelerating yourself to be at the current state of where consumer behavior is. Because if I said to you, create a Tinder-like interface, you'd probably talk about your legacy infrastructure, you talk about technology, you talk about user experience, you talk about UX, you talk about all of these things, which are long, hard, and complex for you as a business. But from the consumer perspective, it's not like they found it challenging to go from what was like a dating site to a Tinder site. They adopted the technology, or Uber, really well. I click a button, a car shows up. And so what button will people have to click to get your product or service? To me, those are the engines of a future-proofing that are way more valuable than sitting back and posturing on what the market might be, how things are going to go, because we got hit with a global pandemic and everything went sideways.
What I'm taking away from what you shared, especially with the Tinder example, which I think is actually very clarifying, is that maybe too often brands, agencies, any type of business entity that's offering something out to the world and in this industry or any other may not be anticipating the speed with which simplification in their competitive marketplace is going to come to fruition. And that's what leaves them so far behind. I can't say that I don't see it very often that something will be suggested as being on the horizon and that thing will be neglected because the belief is that there's no need to move quickly on that. I think this is going to linger in its current state for a long time, and a lot of our competitors are going to stay in that place. So something I'm noticing across the trend of our conversation today is that just like being really honest with yourself, like consistently like shining a mirror back on your business and just having your eyes open to everything that's happening out there in the landscape that you're catering to. So a lot of great insight today, Mitch.
It's such a pleasure talking to you, and thanks for the trip down memory lane. A lot of times I found myself having to jog my memory for what did we do in those scenarios? Because like I said, we sold the business about 7 years ago and I've left about 3 years ago. And not that I haven't looked back, I reflect on it, but I haven't done it.
I think the principles and some of the strategic considerations that you brought up today, not some, but really almost all of them, have permanent relevance, and that's what so many people often will abandon. They're obsessed with what's next and what's new, things that are ephemeral, because that's what they want to put their attention on, when the reality is there are some larger classic principles that are being neglected. And I think that's a lot of what our conversation encompassed. And I just so sincerely appreciate
it. That was great talking to you. And it was illuminating for me to realize that while the platforms may change, the strategies of monetizing them do remain, and the fundamentals are called that for a reason. So thank you, Nora. It's great chatting with you.
Thanks again to Mitch Joel, former agency partner and digital marketing and technology author, speaker, and entrepreneur. Honestly, that short bio doesn't even do Mitch justice because he also has expertise in a series of other things, including music, consumer behavior, publishing, advisory, and more. You can get a better picture of what Mitch does by following him on his socials, including Twitter, LinkedIn, and also Clubhouse. Starting, leading, and selling an agency is no walk in the park. So thanks for all the great advice on running a digital agency today. That's it for this episode. I'm your host, Noor Nasir. We'll have more great episodes of AdTech Unfiltered coming up real soon.